Well, good morning. Welcome. Everyone know that they're in the right room, I hope. We're going to be discussing the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. I'm Terry Eastland. I'm publisher of the Weekly Standard Magazine, and I'm pleased to join this event and to introduce our three panelists and to basically set the stage for a discussion here this morning. We are not going to exhaust this topic. It seems inexhaustible, but we do have three authorities on the statute who I believe can help advance our understanding of it. Jim Capretta, Ian Millhiser, and Jonathan Adler will take about 8 to 10 minutes each, and we will eventually go to the audience for questions. Jim Capretta is a senior fellow with the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a visiting fellow also at the American Enterprise Institute. Jim has worked on committees in both houses of Congress and also in the Office of Management and Budget in the George W. Bush administration. Somehow or other, he acquired an interest in health care 20 years ago and has been afflicted with that ever since, studying it nightly, I'm sure. He writes for many publications, not least the Weekly Standard. Jim will look at the major policy and administrative hurdles that the law faces. In particular, he will focus on the exchanges and also look ahead to what consumers are likely to experience during this next year. Jim will go first. He'll be followed by Ian. Ian is a senior constitutional policy analyst. Do I have that right?
That's right.
For American Progress, where he focuses on the Constitution and also the third branch, the judiciary. Among other notable labors, Ian clerked for Judge Clay of the Sixth Circuit, and he served as a Teach for America core member in Mississippi and in Arkansas.
That's right, on the Arkansas side of the Delta. Right.
Ian has written for a wide variety of publications, among them the New York Times, the Washington Post, the American Prospect, Slate, and the Yale Law and Policy Review. Ian will address how the Act's insurance framework is supposed to function, who the winners and losers are likely to be, and who also will go largely unaffected. Finally, Jonathan Adler will bat third. Jonathan is a professor of law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. He also directs the Center for Business Law and Regulation. He teaches environmental, administrative, and constitutional law and is the author or editor of 4 books on environmental policy. I commented to him earlier, I didn't say I had time to be here with all of that. In any case, we look forward to his remarks. He has written widely for the Journal, Wall Street Journal, and also the Washington Post, for law reviews, and also, not least, for National Review Online, and also the Volokh Conspiracy. Once each of our panelists has spoken, we'll have an opportunity on the panel to respond to any panelists wishing to another panelist, and then we'll go to questions. Jim Capretta, if you will open for us.
Thank you, Terry. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about this very important and consequential law. The starting point for my discussion this morning, I think, should go back to the Supreme Court decision of last summer and a articulation of a proper understanding of where the individual mandate rests post that decision. Of course, that was among the central questions of the law of the case at that time, and the Supreme Court, in a majority opinion of one, essentially, John Roberts wrote the majority opinion, and nobody else agreed with it, but somehow it was upheld. But in that majority opinion of one, there were some very important and interesting things said, and not too many people have noticed yet, but I think that will sink in as the law gets implemented. Essentially, what the Supreme Court said about the individual mandate was that the litigants were right, plaintiffs were right, that the Congress did not have power under the Commerce Clause to compel everybody to buy health insurance in the United States. That was not a legitimate use of the power of the Congress under that clause. And so Roberts then said, essentially, the law, however, the individual mandate can be upheld because it can be viewed as a choice, that people have a choice between signing up for health insurance that the government would like them to sign up for, now regulated very heavily by the federal government, or they can pay, alternatively, a tax. Both are perfectly legitimate choices, lawful choices. It shouldn't be viewed as a penalty necessarily, but viewed as you can pay a tax or you can buy the health insurance. It's your choice. That's essentially where John Roberts came down. Now, why do I bring this up? I bring it up because the law rests on, and the estimates that were made about the law rest on a very fundamentally different understanding of the individual mandate. It rests on an understanding where the individual mandate creates this aura of obligation, where everybody in the country sort of says, you know what, it's now the right thing to do. I'm supposed to buy health insurance. So they often point to the Massachusetts example, and in Massachusetts they had, you know, famously had billboards in Fenway Park, hey, it's time to buy health insurance. It's the right thing to do. And there was a PR campaign built around it, and lots of people in Massachusetts who actually didn't have health insurance before did sign up for health insurance based on that kind of enrollment process. Now the question is, post the Supreme Court decision and the way the law is structured under the healthcare law that passed nationally, will there be the same response? And I think the answer is going to be no on a couple of counts. First of all, it's a very big, diverse, complicated country. This law was quite controversial when it was passed. Essentially, the president constructed and passed a law that requires 80% consent around the country to its provisions. Meanwhile, about 40% of the country likes it and agrees with it. Okay, so they're running uphill on this thing in terms of trying to get everybody to say, yes, it's the right thing to do for everybody in the country to sign up for health insurance. Meanwhile, you've got an actual legal situation that says, hey, I actually don't have to sign up for health insurance. I can pay the tax instead. And the tax instead is very important. Not too many people actually understand how it works. The individual mandate is set up so that it ramps up between 2014 and 2016 and goes from, at the beginning, depending on your income, you pay the greater of $95 per adult in your household or 1% of household income. The following year, those numbers get ratcheted up. You go to 2% of household income in 2015, and it rests at 2.5% of household income thereafter. Now, what does that mean for the average person, for the person where this might be of consequence? If you're an upper income taxpayer, you're going to pay a big penalty if you don't have health insurance. And the IRS is not allowed to use its normal authorities to collect that tax from you. They can't impose civil penalties. They can't garnish your wages. The only thing they can do is, if you're due a refund, they can withhold the refund. Okay? So there's going to be a lot of people on the upper end of the income scale. Yeah, this penalty actually would make a difference. But as you probably understand, most of the issue of people who are not buying health insurance is not on the upper income side of the income scale. It's more the lower and middle class, people who have options or don't have as many options. Now, the penalty, so for instance, the penalty in 2014 for a family of four at $40,000 in household income would be $400. And the health insurance that they're likely to have to buy in the exchanges is going to cost roughly, even for a family of that kind of an income, at about 165% of the poverty line for a family of four, they'd still have to pay a premium of about $1,800. And that's going to become visible to them in the late 2013 timeframe, as the, you know, you're starting to hear about the rates coming out and so on, but you're not hearing yet about the actual premium that people will have to pay depending on their income. I think there's going to be a lot of households who are going to look at this and say, gee whiz, I thought this was going to be free. And the $1,800 versus the $400 penalty is going to become a real issue for a lot more Americans in the coming months. Of course, if you're at twice the poverty rate, $50,000 a year in income, your premium is going to be about $3,200 in 2014 for the standard health insurance plan, and your penalty would only be $500. So that's quite a bit of difference. Now, of course, you get health insurance if you pay the $3,200, and you don't get health insurance if you pay the $500. But you can get health insurance at an open enrollment period at a date to be named later if you pay the taxes instead of paying the health insurance with no penalty to you or your family. So I think this understanding of what the actual mandate requires and how it plays out is going to be crucially important, because the estimates that were put out by the CBO, the estimates, the understanding of how the administration is going about this, is they're going to try to create the aura of obligation by saying, hey, you have to have health insurance now. Otherwise, you know, something bad is going to happen. Well, it turns out that the law actually doesn't really work that way, and I think eventually it will sink in and be understood in this population that they can pay the tax instead. And many, many, many millions of people are likely to take that option when they figure out it's to their financial advantage to do so. Now, what does that mean for implementation of the law? I think a lot of what is going to be discussed about the implementation in the coming in the coming months is going to center around, hey, is there momentum behind enrollment in the new exchanges around the country? The states have the option under the law to either initiate the building of the exchanges themselves or forego doing so and have the federal government build it as a backup. 33 states decided not to build the exchanges. 17 states plus the District of Columbia have chosen to do so. You will hear in the coming months lots of discussion around that, but it's quite clear already that where you have a blue state governor on the ground, absolutely gung-ho to try to enroll as many people as possible, that's where the president's going to go and say, hey, this law is working. He was just in California last week. Expect them to be in Maryland and Massachusetts and New York State quite a bit in the coming months because they have a governor there who's for it. They're going to try to beat the bushes to get as many people signed up as possible and create some momentum around the subsidy structure that goes around these exchanges. In lots of other parts of the country, you're going to get very feeble enrollment. And for all the reasons I described about the individual mandate, plus the fact that there is just a much less visible and robust presence going to be there in those states pushing people to try to sign up. So I think in the coming months there's going to be an emerging discussion around what is success and what is failure. And I would just remind everyone what the Congressional Budget Office said at enactment. The Congressional Budget Office, this would be my final point, so I know we're supposed to be doing this for a few minutes, but the Congressional Budget Office at the time of enactment predicted that in 2014, we would be down to 31 million people who are uninsured. We're likely to be at 50 million people uninsured in 2014, based on my sense of where the exchanges will come out and potentially 5 million people enrolled in the exchanges next year. Another very important corollary point is that the president famously opposed the individual mandate in the 2008 campaign and used it as a point of distinction in his campaign with Senator Clinton. In fact, he made it a big deal. He ran ads against Senator Clinton for her support of the individual mandate and made that as a huge deal for why voters in the Democratic primary should vote for him as opposed to his opponent. Then, of course, within weeks of becoming president, he changed his mind. Why did he change his mind? Because he wanted to be the president who was, quote, for universal coverage. There's a memo that went into the president during the spring of 2009 saying without the individual mandate, the uninsured rate would still be over 30 million people. And he rejected that, saying, hey, if we're going to go through healthcare reform, we need to cover everybody. And if with the individual mandate, they were predicting they could get the uninsured rate down to 10 million or so. Turns out now, the Congressional Budget Office said at the time of enactment, well, the high water mark is going to be, we're going to get the uninsured number down to about 23 million in 2019. That would be as low as we would get, not 10 million. Well, they've revised their estimates. It's now up to about 30 million people. And candidly, I expect that number to go north. That as people understand what the individual mandate actually means, as enrollment is less robust, as the exchanges are not as highly thought of in the future as they are maybe at the time of enactment, I think you're going to find that the country has not enacted a universal coverage program. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having me. One thing that I love about this topic is a year from now, we're all going to know the answer. And we're going to know the answer in a real sense. I mean, I normally argue about court cases, and, you know, in a court case it comes down, you could still say, well, I still agree with the dissent. With this, you know, we're going to know in a year what health insurance premiums are throughout the country. We're going to know for a year who is insured and who isn't insured. And so, like, there's a certain point where this ceases to become speculation. Now it is speculation. You know, now we are trying to figure out, people are trying to look at the numbers, they're trying to look at various factors to determine what's going to happen. And the good news from my side is that the insurers, the people who know the market best, seem to believe, are acting in a way that indicates that they think it's going to work. So before I go into explaining why that is, I think it's important to understand where this law came from. So in 1989, the Heritage Foundation put out a paper where they argued for a health plan that includes, and this is a quote from them, we must mandate all households obtain adequate insurance. That became the basis of a proposal to the Bush White House by a conservative health economist named Mark Pauley. It then became the basis for the 1993 Republican alternative to the Clinton health plan. So this is an idea that came up in conservative circles. And the reason why is because unlike Medicare for All, unlike other proposals that have been on the table in the past, this is a proposal that preserves a role for the private markets, that allows people who are cut out of our current system to continue to get health care, but still uses private insurance as the primary method of delivery, rather than something like a Medicare for All option where everyone is covered by a government program. And one nice advantage of a market-based system is that markets bring honesty. What we're seeing happen with the insurers is there's this silly dance going on where the insurers talk about, oh, if this happens, we're going to have to jack up our premiums, and there's all kinds of studies. Jim, I'm actually surprised you didn't cite some of these studies predicting catastrophic spikes in premiums. You know, the Lieutenant Governor of Ohio predicted 88% premium hikes recently. Executive Vice President of Blue Cross in Washington State predicted a 50 to 75% premium hike. So they predict these terrible outcomes. But the same Blue Cross that predicted 50 to 75% premium hikes, when they actually produced their Washington plan, it didn't have anything close to that. So what we now know, because the rates have been released in Washington, is that premiums in 2014 are going to go up 7% in the state of Washington. And to put that 7% in perspective, for the last 4 years, the average rate of increase each year was about 6.5%. So you're looking at an increase that is in line with what we've seen over previous years. The same thing's true in California. There was an insurance group that predicted hikes up to 66% in California. Actual increases, we now know, turn out to be similar to Washington's. And Jim, I take your point that we don't know a lot about the red states. That's because the red states are going to be covered by the federal exchange, and we just don't have the specific numbers yet for the federally run exchanges. I'll revise my opinion if those numbers look different. But the numbers that we have now indicate that the insurers are predicting catastrophic outcomes, and then when they actually produce their prices, the market is working, and they're producing prices that do not reflect their predictions. So what we're seeing now from a lot of the writers who oppose the law is a discussion of the plight of this unusual creature, the healthy 25-year-old man. There's a ton of pieces that have been written about how terrible it's going to be for Mr. Healthy 25-year-old man once this law goes into effect, and there's a good reason for that. The way that insurance companies love healthy 25-year-old men. I mean, the way that the insurance industry works is they pool a bunch of money from people who pay in, and then when someone has health expenses, they get to take money out of that pool. So if you're a healthy 25-year-old man, that means you're healthy, that means you're probably not going to get sick anytime soon, and it means you're not going to get pregnant. So the insurers look at you, and they think you are a cash cow because you are going to pay into the system, and you are unlikely to pay out. That means that healthy 25-year-old men traditionally have gotten very discounted rates because the insurers want them in their insurance pool. And if anyone is going to experience higher premiums in a more regulated market, it's going to be the healthy 25-year-old man. It's going to be the people who insurers want to have in the pools because they typically haven't had very high health expenses. So here's what we know about what's going to happen to the healthy 25-year-old man. First of all, 90% of young adults currently have health insurance either through a government program or through their employer. The overwhelming majority of them are going to see no changes at all under this law. Of the remaining 10%, most of those will qualify for subsidies that offset some of their premium costs. And to give you a sense of how that subsidy works, If we're talking about a single 25-year-old man with a $45,000 a year income, so that puts him at the very top of the range for what they're eligible for subsidies. The California Exchange predicts a monthly cost of $213 for that man. But $45,000 a year is actually a pretty well-off 25-year-old. The median individual income in this country is $27,000 a year. That's individual income, not household income. When you're younger, you tend to make less. So most 25-year-old men are not making $45,000 a year, and those that are typically have health insurance through their employer. So let's take the guy making the median. If you're the same guy making $27,000 a year is going to pay $169 a month in the same for the same plan in the same exchange. You give that man a child, and now he's paying $115 because the way that the subsidies work, as your family size increases, the size of the subsidies increase, and then you give him a child and a spouse who's in grad school, so the spouse isn't bringing in an additional income, and the premiums go down to $74 a month. So there is going to be a universe of relatively affluent, healthy individuals who are going to pay more premiums. But the overwhelming majority of people, even in that cohort, are going to either see no change or they're going to be better off because of this law. One of my colleagues estimated that the universe of young adults who are likely to see higher premiums adds up to less than 0.5% of the population. So if you're expecting some sort of mass uprising because everyone suddenly sees these catastrophic premium increases, look elsewhere. You're going to be disappointed looking there. All of this, of course, has to be paid for. And this law does pay for it. It pays for it through a combination of cost-saving measures that reduce the cost of care without necessarily changing the quality of care. It does it through reduced subsidies to the insurance companies. And it does that in large part through primarily high-income tax hikes. And if you don't like the fact that this law is funded through by tax hikes on upper-income earners, the main thing I can say to you is try winning an election. At the end of the day, the American people elected a Democrat twice. And the idea that when the American people vote for a Democrat, where somebody could have somewhat higher taxes on upper income earners, and we're going to see that money used to pay for beneficial programs for people who are not in upper income earners, isn't really a surprise. You know, at the end of the day, if we truly believe in government of the people, by the people, and for the people, we have to respect the fact that that's the decision the American people made. And if you don't like this law, your remedy will potentially come in 2016. And with that said, I think Jonathan is going to talk about how unelected judges can step in and change that prediction.
That's actually not quite what I'm going to say, but close. My biggest difference with Ian is I don't think we're going to know in a year what the effects of the law is. I don't think anyone that actually has looked at the way the law is implemented and the way it is written believes that. That's because, as the Congressional Research Service has said, it's going to take decades of rulemakings to fully implement the law. And as we know already, this law is going to spawn numerous legal challenges, far more than the typical law of size and scope. And I want to say a little bit about why that is and what that means. Any large expansive statute triggers a large amount of litigation. The Clean Air Act of 1990, for example, has spawned at this point well over two decades of litigation trying to figure out what various portions of it mean. So any statute like this would do that. But when you take a statute that on top of that covers 1/7 of the economy, as is the case with healthcare, is incredibly complicated and complex, such that even many of its supporters weren't sure of what it was they were supporting when they voted on it. A bill that, as this one is so incredibly poorly written that, for example, in some places it has duplicate section numbers, it has clear drafting errors, that you have something that is difficult to implement because it's not always clear what it means and what it's supposed to do, and the pieces don't fit together very well. And so someone has to figure out how to make that work. And then on top of that, when you're talking about healthcare, You're talking about the sort of thing that people care very deeply about in a way that they don't care so much about the Clean Air Act. I mean, I do a lot of environmental policy and I teach environmental law. I care about the Clean Air Act. But your average person on the street cares a lot more about contraception, abortion, end-of-life decisions, rationing of care to the terminally ill, things like that, than they do about your typical regulatory decision. So the willingness to fight against policies that one disagrees with, even at substantial cost, is far greater in this context than it is in the average regulatory context. And again, we're already seeing that litigation over the contraception mandate, which it will probably end up before the Supreme Court within the next 2 years, is evidence of that. But so are some of the complaints that are now starting to be filed by groups on the other side of the political spectrum about the way the law is being implemented. I believe it was just a week or so ago, for example, the National Women's Legal Center filed a complaint with HHS arguing that it needs to force some employers to require, or to force employers to provide maternity coverage for dependent female children of employees, and that failure to do so would be discriminatory and in violation of a provision of the act. And we're going to see increasing numbers of those, that sort of suit as well. So this law, in many respects, is a perfect storm of litigation. And it's even more so because, again, unlike the typical large regulatory statute, it is very poorly drafted, and in part because the law that was enacted was not the law that anyone intended to have enacted. And we've been forgetting that. But New York Times just had a story that recounted this history just in the past week or so, but it's worth remembering. The law that was enacted was the Senate bill. The Senate bill was not intended to become the law. What was intended to become the law was being produced in a House Senate conference. And what the House Senate conference was putting together was in many key respects quite different than the PPACA. Among other things, it was going to abandon state exchanges and move to a pure federal exchange model. But what happened was Scott Brown got elected in Massachusetts. There was no longer a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And so the bill that people were carefully piecing together had to be set aside. And the Senate bill was enacted and then amended through the reconciliation process, but the reconciliation process, for a variety of reasons, cannot be used to fully rewrite a law. So not all of the changes that had been agreed to or that were going to be agreed to in the House Senate conference could be adopted. And as many supporters of the time acknowledge in their, you know, their letters by various healthcare experts pointing this out, the real question at the time was to take what was a bad bill in the views of its primary supporters, or no bill. And the choice was, quite explicitly, to take a bad bill in the hopes that it could either be amended later on or fixed in the administrative process. And we know it's not going to be amended in the near future, which means the only way to try and smooth off some of these rough edges is through the administrative process, and that means agencies have to be creative in the way they interpret certain provisions, try and interpret their authority in expansive ways, and that, of course, will lead to yet more litigation and certainly a great deal of uncertainty about precisely how the law will be implemented. And one good example of that is an area that I've done some writing on with regard to the implementation of exchanges. The law, as written, tells states to create exchanges. Now, we all know the federal government can't simply tell states what to do. That's clearly unconstitutional under cases like New York and Prince, as reaffirmed in NFIB versus Sebelius. The federal government cannot commandeer states. The law was written as if all states would create exchanges willingly. As Jim already mentioned, 33 states have said no. The law assumed that states would create exchanges and then provided for tax credits, federal tax credits, and cost-sharing subsidies to insurers for the purchase of qualifying health insurance plans in state exchanges. As the law is written, it does not provide for tax credits for the purchase of health insurance on federal exchanges. And the law is very explicit. It provides tax credits for the purchase of insurance on exchanges created under Section 1311, which only refers to state exchanges, and then goes on to say established by a state. So as if there was any doubt That's the only way it provides for tax credits. The IRS, in conjunction with HHS, has issued a rule saying, oh, well, for our purposes, we're going to treat Section 1311 exchanges as the same as Section 1321 exchanges, even though they're different section numbers. And we're going to say Section 1321 exchanges, those created by the federal government, can also be a source of tax credits, even though, again, the law says tax credits are only available for the purchase of insurance plans in exchanges, quote, established by a state. The IRS did no statutory analysis for this. There was none in the Federal Register. Cursory one paragraph explanation saying, well, there's nothing in the legislative history that says we can't do this, and we think this is broadly consistent with the statute. The sort of justification of a rule that I tend to show my administrative law students is not the sort of thing that satisfies reasoned decision-making and the concise general statement that we expect from agencies. In response to congressional investigators, the IRS has also not been able to put forth any internal statutory analysis that it did. It just failed to put in the Federal Register. There just was none. But this is the rule that it has issued, and this is important not just because it affects the availability of subsidies and tax credits. And I should note, the provision of tax credits and subsidies doesn't make something cost less. It shifts the incidence of the costs. But it'd be a bizarre world, or it's a bizarre understanding of economics to say that because we've given you a subsidy, something costs less. No, it means you pay less. But that cost is borne by somebody somewhere. These are cost-shifting mechanisms. These are not cost-reduction mechanisms. But the other reason this is important is because the way the law is written, the trigger for the employer penalty is that a employee has received a tax credit for the purchase of a health insurance plan on exchange. So if there's no tax credit, there can be no employer penalty. And so on this basis, there's litigation now both pending in a federal district court in Oklahoma and here in D.C. Challenging the IRS rule along these grounds, which would also challenge the ability to impose the penalty on employers for failing to provide health insurance. Moreover, the way the penalty for what used to be called the individual mandate is calculated, availability, whether or not subsidies are available, affects the incidence of penalties on individuals who fail to obtain qualifying health insurance, because the penalty is a function in part of the cost compared to someone's income. And these suits are pending now, and certainly depending on what happens with this litigation, that can change dramatically what happens at the state level in terms of implementation of this law. I'll probably stop here because I know we have lots of questions and things to talk about. But the broader point is however these lawsuits come out, however the contraception mandate lawsuits come out, however the lawsuits filed by doctor-owned hospitals that were filed before, that will be filed again, turn out, however the eventual litigation over the Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB, turn out when those suits eventually get filed, the idea that in a year from now the dust will have settled and that we will now see the PPACA in all its glory functioning like a smoothly oiled machine, that's crazy. Both because of the way the law is written, what federal agencies have to do to implement it, and because of the questions that courts will have to resolve in terms of implementation, it will be a long time before we fully understand what it is that Congress enacted. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan, and we will now turn to the panel and see if there are comments that any of you wish to make about the other panelists' comments.
Absolutely, gosh. I need about 20 minutes to go through your comments, but let me just mention two things. One is on premiums. I didn't bring it up in my comments because I wanted to focus on the operation of mandate. The mandate, of course, is very related to premiums. If you don't have enrollment by the famous 25-year-olds that Ian's so unconcerned about, then premiums for everybody else will go up. So the reason to be concerned about the 25-year-old, and candidly, it's not just 25-year-olds, it's healthy 30-year-olds and 35-year-olds and 40-year-olds and 45-year-olds. There's approximately 15 to 20 million people in the United States that are enrolled in the individual health insurance market, and it's quite true that in most cases, they're relatively healthy people. And those people are going to see premium increases. The very low income of that population could potentially see a premium increase and a subsidy that's enough to offset it. But the calculation that Ian went through to say, oh, it's only going to be 0.5% of the population, that's not the calculation I think is going to be the reality. Let me talk about California. California made a big splash of saying the premiums won't change very much. And what did they do? They compared the exchange premiums submitted by the way, three plans in California, really robust competition, three plans that are inclined politically, candidly, to be as supportive as possible of what's going on in California, joined into the exchange process. They're probably going to lose money in year one and make it up in year two. I mean, that's the way this politics is working. Their premiums were compared to the non-individual market from the prior year, to small group premiums, saying, well, this is more comparable, the benefit packages is a little bit bigger. And that, well, that's actually not what people are buying. The people that are in the individual market in California, which is fairly large, are buying rated products that are very often skinny plans, and they are very often healthy people. They're not all 25-year-old, though. They're 30-year-old, 35-year-old, self-employed people that have their own business and want to buy in the individual market for whatever reason. They will see premium increases. Some estimates indicate that if you just look at the Kaiser plan, this was in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago, right? Somebody said, look, it's going to be hard to do a real comparison of this, but if you actually get a Kaiser plan that's being offered in the individual market today for this certain type of population compared to the same product, essentially, that Kaiser's going to be offering in the new exchange next year, their premiums are going up by basically 75%. And so, yeah, there are going to be premium increases. Is it dispositive of why the law is good or bad? No. But it is quite true that the administration and certainly the law's apologists have never admitted the fact that these people in the individual market are going to pay higher premiums. And if you actually go and talk to the insurance industry, they have been saying, you know, essentially what's been going on is they've been saying since 2010, really 2009, hey, there's going to be premium increases for these individual market people. But they're so scared to death of this administration. It's unbelievable. They've buried all their analyses, put them on their website, but never draw any attention. These things have been out in the public domain for years, showing what the actual premium increases are going to be. And on average across the country, they'll be probably 30 to 50%, depending on the state. So is it the end of the world? Perhaps not, but it's going to be a big premium increase for a lot of people in the individual market. That's just the reality of it. The second point is on this famous point of, hey, it's only the rich are going to pay for the healthcare law. Totally, completely false. The premium, there's taxes in this law that impose taxes on all health insurance premiums sold in the insured marketplace. By the way, completely irrationally exempts the self-employed plans. So it is totally, like, of all the, you know, they put this together, law together, it's like they just slapped it all together. Totally crazy. You have this very large premium tax that applies only to insured plans, driving a huge incentive to get into the self-insured market. Another dynamic to keep your eye on. But who's going to pay for a premium tax? It's everybody. It's not the rich. It's the people that Ian's concerned about, people I'm concerned about. They're all going to pay the tax too. There's a medical device tax. It applies to everybody. That gets passed on to every consumer in the country. There's a pharma tax. You think pharma companies are paying the tax? You don't understand taxation. It's going to go right into the products they're selling. So finally, half the bill was financed through Medicare cuts, essentially. Okay? These Medicare cuts, they make it seem like they've done this great thing in Medicare, this new operation that's going to make it all very efficient. There was nothing of the sort in the law like that. All they did was apply huge across-the-board cuts to every provider providing services to the Medicare program. It doesn't make any distinctions based on quality. All the money that CBO said would be saved was saved through across-the-board cuts, not through accountable care organizations and demonstrations and blah, blah, blah. That's all zero. The cuts come from across-the-board cuts of seniors accessing care. The people that run the numbers for the Medicare program say that by 2030, essentially 25% of the nation's hospitals would have to stop taking Medicare because their reimbursement rates would be so low. Okay? And what does the actuary say when he looks at these numbers? He says, they're not going to happen. I'm going to go into another long discussion about why they were discounted. That's another issue for another day.
I think Ian might wish to respond.
Sure thing. So, I mean, I don't want to get in one-by-one on every point that was made there. I do want to point out that we have a very different idea of how for-profit businesses operate. So I do not think that for-profit businesses, the executives, the shareholders, the boards of those businesses say, well, it would be unprofitable for us to take a loss for an entire year on these premiums. But I am a Democrat. And for that reason, I am going to, despite the fact that I have a fiduciary duty to my shareholders, and despite the obligations that we all have to run our business as a business, I am going to announce very low premiums because it will be good for Barack Obama. I do not believe that.
First of all, nobody's announced very low premiums.
I
total this character.
Well, again, we have premiums that have been announced.
They are not very low.
That have been announced in several states. What we have seen is we have seen premium increases that are in line, in some cases slightly higher, than the premium increases that we have seen in past years on a year-by-year basis. Part of the reason why the premiums are increasing is because the quality of the plans that are available, you're basically taking out the bottom sector of the market. And in many cases, the bottom sector of the market looks disastrous. And on my way here, someone emailed me a piece about a plan that's offered in Ohio that has a $25,000 a year deductible. Now, I don't know who's dumb enough to buy that plan. That plan won't exist because even though that, you know, that plan is called insurance, that isn't actually insurance. And so one thing that does happen is that the people at the bottom sector of the market, you know, those plans will not exist because there is a minimum standard that's required under this law. As I said in my opening remarks, the primary mechanism by which this law manages costs is through subsidies. It is through making sure that people who cannot afford insurance have a sufficient subsidy to enable them to purchase it. The way that the subsidies work is that they increase in size as your family increases in size, so that the people who have the least financial burdens, single people, have the lowest subsidies. The people who have families to take care of have bigger subsidies because it's tied to the poverty rate, and the poverty rate is tied to the size of your family. And as I said, there will be some people, you know, such as affluent 25-year-old men, who will wind up paying higher premiums. Most people who earn relatively high income already have insurance. They already have it through their employer. The primary universe of people who do not have insurance right now are either people who cannot afford it, they'll benefit from the subsidies, or they are people who have pre-existing conditions and for that reason are not able to obtain insurance. And so, you know, again, the universe of people who do not have insurance is fairly small in this country, and it is mostly made up of people either can't afford insurance, the subsidies will help them, and it's made up of people who, because of medical underwriting, cannot obtain it at any price. Real quick to Jonathan's point about the litigation, you know, I'm familiar with the Oklahoma lawsuit. I'll just say two things about it. First of all, it's unlikely we're going to get a resolution on those lawsuits quickly. First, you know, the appropriate party who has standing there is probably the businesses who may have to pay a penalty, and that won't be assessed for a little while. There's also a Tax Anti-Injunction Act issue here. I suspect that the courts will say that the Tax Anti-Injunction Act does apply. So you could be looking until 2016 before you have a final resolution from the courts as to whether or not the federally run subsidies get to pay out tax subsidies. And just as a practical matter, after these exchanges have been operating for close to 2 years, it strikes me as very, very unlikely that the courts are going to say, oh, retroactively, all that money that you guys got, you can't have that. I don't know if they order them to give it back or if they just order prospective relief, but in either event, that strikes me as unlikely practically. It also strikes me as unlikely as a matter of law. And if you want me to bore you because it involves going line by line through quotes that I've written down, there are a lot of ambiguities, Jonathan, you're right, that it's not a very well-written statute. There are a lot of ambiguities in the law, but of course what we know from Chevron is when there's ambiguities and when the appropriate agency has offered a plausible reading for how that should be read. The court should defer to that. I'm happy if people really want me to go through these awful quotes that I have to explain what some of the other plausible readings are and why I think there's really not very much chance at all that the courts are going to say that federal money will not be paid out, or federal tax tax subsidies will not be provided through the federal exchanges.
Jonathan, do you have anything to add?
Two quick things. One, and this line is going around a lot, Jonathan Cohen has a column today suggesting that a policy that provides coverage of catastrophic expenses but has either a high deductible or doesn't pay for, say, doctor's visits is not insurance, is Orwellian. Insurance is about managing risk. So a policy that protects you against risk is insurance. A policy that provides you with doctor's visits without copays may or may not be a good thing from a policy standpoint, but that is not insurance. We call that health insurance because we've lumped it all together. But that's actually essentially a prepaid package of medical services. And when talking about something like this, we should be careful with our language, because the reality is a lot of things that are offered now, my state of Ohio, for example, where the 88% predicted increase for rates next year is based on that estimate that was released this week, is based on rates that have been filed by insurers within the state, and those rates are available through the state. You can get those filings. A lot of certain plans won't be offered, and a lot of things that won't be offered are actually a lot closer to true insurance than what the healthcare law mandates. We have a debate about whether or not as a country we prefer true insurance as a way of dealing with medical expenses, or whether or not we prefer requiring the provision of certain services, essentially a prepaid form or paid for by the government or by an employer or whatever. But we should be clear that is not insurance. That is other things that we like. That's a way we want to deliver healthcare and health services. The only other point was on litigation. I don't believe there are any ambiguities about this provision. I think when a statute says, provide purchase and exchange under Section 1311, it mentions the express statutory provision, and then says established by a state, it is pretty clear that Section 1311 means Section 1311, and established by a state, particularly if it's defined in the statute, which it is, means established by a state. There's no ambiguity there. That language is repeated multiple times in the statute, and it is black letter law that agencies receive no deference on the question of whether a statute is ambiguous in the first place. That is a pure question of law that even the majority in the Arlington decision from 2 weeks ago acknowledged is to be decided by the courts in the first instance, not the agencies. The IRS, after finalizing its rule and failing to provide any explanation, failing to have done any of its own internal statutory interpretation, developing the rule, and with the help of some outside experts, has come up with a bunch of explanations and efforts to try and find ambiguity in other portions of the statute, to try and insert ambiguity into these provisions. They don't work. It requires basically assuming that certain language in the statute doesn't exist, like the phrase established by a state. And you essentially have to read that out of the statute in multiple places for their interpretation to hold. Many of the other arguments that have been made, well, no one would have ever proposed something like this. Well, first person to make that argument in response to Michael Cannon and I pointing out this aspect of the statute, himself had written an article proposing that a way you encourage states to encourage exchanges is you tell them your citizens only get tax credits if you create an exchange. That's a rationale. You can't force states to create an exchange. You've already spent all the money you had on Medicaid expansion to try and bribe states with promises of direct funding. What other leverage do you have? Well, one way is tax credits. That was actually proposed by Professor Tim Jost, who was very involved in the development and drafting of the bill and in the defense of this rule now. And we know there are many aspects of this law and many laws that, in fact, a condition benefits to private citizens or private entities based on a state's behavior as a way of inducing state cooperation. Most of the other arguments that have been made about why this rule is justified, it's congressional intent. There's not a single statement anyone has been able to find saying, contemporaneous with the law's drafting, that tax credits would be available in federal exchanges. There are statements that every state would have an exchange, which we knew everyone thought. Everyone thought, because everyone thought states would create them. Their statement saying tax credits would be available in every state, but again, that's because everyone assumed every state would create its own exchange. But no one said, oh, federal exchanges will get tax credits. The IRS hasn't shown any, found an example of this. HHS hasn't found an example of this. Tim Jones hasn't found an example of this. We've been asking for folks to provide evidence of this for over a year now. We have an 80-page article for those of you that have insomnia that goes through what legislative history there is. And in fact, it's all consistent with the plain text of the statute. Now, will this case be over soon? Well, in the Oklahoma case, there is an oral argument on the government's motion to dismiss next week. And in the D.C. case last week, a motion for summary judgment was filed by the plaintiffs, which are both employers and individuals, asking, and part of the basis for the motion for summary judgment is precisely the point that Ian mentioned, which is if, as they would argue, and I would argue, what the IRS has proposed is illegal, it would be better to cut it off now than to try and undo it once it happens. And you know, we'll see when and if, the government, I'm sure, will respond to that motion, and we'll see how the court responds. But that motion was filed just last week.
So a few things real quick, just because, you know, since you, if you want to get into the details of what the statute says, first of all, like, I think the fact that y'all have actually managed to find legislative history supporting your position proves that Scalia is right about legislative history, that you really can't find anything in there.
No one's found the reverse.
Let me talk. So I'm going to just not talk about legislative history at all because I'm a textualist and I think that we should look at what the statute says. So first of all, there's a provision in section 1311(d)(1) which states outright an exchange shall be a government entity or non-profit entity that is established by a state. So if you read that in isolation, that seems to suggest that there can be no such thing as a federally started exchange, because the only thing that it allows by that language is a state-run exchange. The problem is that that reading does not make sense. And the reason it doesn't make sense is if you page down to section 1321(c)(1), it explicitly authorizes the secretary to create a federally run exchange in the event that a state does not do so. So you're faced with this problem where you have statutory language where the most natural reading in isolation doesn't make sense in the context of a larger statute. We can't just read that out of the statute, so there must have been another intended meaning. And in the context of section 1221(c)(1), the most logical meaning of that phrase, an exchange shall be a government entity or nonprofit entity that is established by a state, is a definitional statement. It is a declaration that an exchange established under this law shall be deemed as an exchange established by a state. Second, the language authorizing the secretary to establish the federal exchanges says that quote, the secretary shall establish and operate such exchange within the state, and the secretary shall take such actions as are necessary to implement such other requirements. Now, there's a lot of things going on there. I'll just point to one, which is that the phrase such other requirements is completely ambiguous. We don't know what that means. Is the provision of tax credits an other requirement? Doesn't say. That's an ambiguity. And so, again, we go to Chevron to figure out what that could be. Going on down.
I'll finish all of these points because none of them touch on the relevant statutory language.
The Act as amended by the Reconciliation Act provides reporting requirements both for the federal exchanges and for the state exchanges regarding the amount that's being paid out in tax subsidies. It would be nonsensical for that reporting requirement to exist if Congress didn't already understand the statute to contain a reporting requirement. And finally, the most important phrase, the phrase established by a state actually appears multiple times within the statute. But at the relevant point, at the point where it determines who is and is not eligible for exchanges, or I'm sorry, eligible for tax subsidies, the phrase that it uses is an exchange established by the state, not a state, the state. Now, normally, when we have a statute that consistently uses one phraseology, and then it suddenly changes to use a different phraseology, we understand that to mean that Congress meant something different there. And a state means something different than the state. John Kerry is the Secretary of State, not because he has responsibilities over Alabama or New York. He's the Secretary of State because we normally understand the state to refer to a sovereign entity such as a nation state.
So it depends on
the
definition of
ambiguities that will be questioned in that period. There are many ambiguities in this statute. There are multiple permissible readings of this statute. And when you have a statute which is subject to multiple permissible readings, the courts shall defer under Chevron to the agency's reading. So Jonathan, I really admire your skills as an advocate here. This is a creative theory. The fact that, I know you cited in articles actual legislative history that you think supports you, and I think that is such tremendous diligence that you're able to find that. I admire your skills as an advocate that you've been able to come up with this argument. It's not going to win.
Well, the relevant language you quoted at the end, you truncated. What it said is it says that you're eligible for insurance if you purchase a plan through, quote, an exchange established by the state under Section 1311. Section 1311 only provides for the creation of state exchanges. Federal exchanges are Section 1321. The reconciliation amendments that Ian mentioned felt the need to identify state exchanges and federal exchanges separately in those subsequent amendments, which means that Congress recognized in its later enactment that if it wanted to deal with both state and federal exchanges, it had to identify them separately. Moreover, in the reconciliation amendments, Congress realized that if it wanted territorial exchanges to be treated like state exchanges, it had to specifically do that, and it did so. It did not do the same for federal exchanges. The reality is the language of the statute is quite clear, and again, we'll see what happens. But CRS, Congressional Research Service, has said, hey, straightforward reading of the statute would suggest that this is correct, and then goes on to say, well, here are all the ways we try and find ambiguity, but again, I don't think it's there. And just on our article, we actually went looking for legislative history, because what we expected to find was an interesting case where the text of the statute said one thing, and the legislative history said something else.
Okay.
All right.
In fact, we didn't, and it's interesting that the IRS relies not on text. It says, well, legislative history is consistent with this, but they can't provide any evidence. They can't provide any contemporaneous evidence of their own. And they didn't engage in any statutory analysis of their own. So even if I were to concede that their interpretation was permissible, under traditional APA review, their rule would have to be thrown out because they did not engage in the sort of reasoned decision making that is required of an agency in the first place. And that actually is a claim in the complaint that was filed in the Oklahoma case.
If we might. We are just about out of time, but we do have time for a question or two. If you would direct by name, your question, that would be helpful.
Okay.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks, John.
Oh my gosh.
We got a whole
line back here, and you're supposed to use the microphone. We've all been staying in line.
Go ahead.
Fine.
Go ahead and ask your question, then we'll go to the back.
I'm sure that probably won't.
I have a question.
Go ahead and ask your question. If you would direct it to one of the parties here.
My question is primarily for Professor Adler, but I'd ask each of the panelists to give me a likelihood as a percentage. As Professor Adler pointed out quite unequivocally, and I think correctly, the bill that became law is the Senate bill, but the bill that was interpreted by the Supreme Court is a revenue-raising bill, a tax bill. The Constitution requires that all bills raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives. As a percentage, what do you think the likelihood is that the validity of the law will be challenged based on that constitutional ground?
There is a pending lawsuit, and the chances of that lawsuit succeeding are somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.0005%. It's a political question, as many circuits have held equivalent questions are. Moreover, the use of shell bills is a well-established practice by Congress, and I would be shocked if lower courts, and particularly the Supreme Court, were to upset that set of expectations. In terms of my view of the way government should operate, I don't think Congress should use shell bills for things like this. But they do, they have, and just as courts won't police say the enrolled bill rule, they're not going to police this.
So is that provision of the Constitution then moot? permanently?
It is entrusted to, like many political questions, it is entrusted to enforcement and interpretation by the legislative branch. And there are many provisions of the Constitution that are similarly interpreted by courts to essentially, if we don't like the way Congress is interpreting and enforcing that provision, the remedy is us at the ballot box. Not every constitutional problem is remediable in court.
Question.
Real quickly, Shaq Hill from Centerville. We've talked a lot about policy, we've talked a lot about provisions, but can one of the panelists tell me how does this actually improve the healthcare delivery to the citizen?
Sure. I mean, first of all, you have millions of people who have pre-existing conditions who simply cannot get healthcare right now, period. It's estimated that between 25,000 and 45,000 people die every year because they don't have insurance, and for that reason they don't get the health care they need. So I support this law because I think life is better than death, and I think that making sure that those people get to live is a valid objective. That is something that the government has a right to do, that is something the government should do. I can go into, if you want, the various cost-saving provisions in the law, because it's not just important to expand the base of people with insurance, it's important to make sure that we don't pay too much for our insurance. So there's a combination of reductions in subsidies to health insurers. There are various provisions to make sure that that hospitals provide better care. So for example, if you obtain a hospital-borne illness while you're in the hospital, Medicare will pay the hospital less if you're a Medicare patient. If you are readmitted to a hospital after having recently been admitted, Medicare will pay less, and those exist to encourage hospitals to come up with better procedures to make sure that doesn't happen. You know, they can be very simple procedures. I was in the hospital recently. One of the first things that they did was they put socks with treads on my feet. And the reason they did that is because someone found out that a significant percentage of people were tripping and falling and injuring themselves in the hospital. And so at very little cost, they could protect my health by buying some socks and putting them on my feet.
All thanks to Obamacare. Thank goodness.
one last question, and then we'll break.
I think I should respond to that.
You may. Go right ahead.
The main thrust of the healthcare law was to move the resource allocation decisions in the American healthcare system more toward the federal government. So the federal government is involved in subsidizing a lot more health insurance, expanded the role of Medicaid quite dramatically. It is overseeing rate systems in the insurance system, obviously through the exchanges. As anybody who understands the political economy in the United States understands, the federal government is going to get more and more involved in allocation decisions, resource allocation decisions in the health system. That's what the law is mainly about, moving power and authority, move money around to the federal government in the health system. What will that do to the quality of American health care? That's the basic issue. And will the federal government manage the health system better than an alternative approach to managing resource allocation in the health system? That's really the central question. And of course, absolutely, we want to make sure everyone has access to the health care they need at the moment they need it. But I have a view, and I think a lot of people have a view, that the federal government will mismanage this very badly. That the federal government doesn't make very good decisions about how to allocate resources. We have lots of evidence of that in both the Medicare and Medicaid programs, where they underpay quite a bit in a lot of circumstances and overpay a lot in a lot of circumstances, because the federal government never gets the price right. And so in a system as complex and big as this, if the federal government is micromanaging prices, as it's going to try to do under this law, it will misallocate resources, and then people will die. So, yeah, I'm for life, but I'm for making sure our health system maximizes the quality of the system going forward, that's innovative, that you get the right service to the right people at the right moment. And there's so much confidence in this bill that the federal government can do all of that, and it's entirely misplaced.
Well, again, the federal government isn't setting the price of insurance. The insurance companies are.
I think we've probably exhausted the topic for now. We've run about 5 minutes over, so thank you all. Thank you all for your time.